Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Drum and Drummer, a podcast focused on drums, drumming and drummers. I'm George Pickering and that's Ben Winty, and we are both professional drummers in this business we call music. So stick around and join us as we pass the time whilst trying to stay in time.
So I had to learn how to kind of go crazy, but still hold back a little bit.
Drum and Drummer. That is the name.
That is it.
Fucking Ben hell. Winty. Your Ben intros Winty. Are getting worse and worse.
I'm just keeping it spicy, boy. Keeping it spicy.
That's just... Can I say, when I saw Stone Roses at Isle of Wight Festival, that was all they said. They just reminded me. I went to see them. Ian Brown walks on
stage. Well, they kept
saying
Drum and Drummer.
No, can you imagine? God, we'd get some listens then. Walked on stage, Stone Roses, and then they played their set and walked off. Amazing.
Cut the waffle.
Yeah.
I did a tour once with Oxygen Thief, and we were also the backing band for the headline artist.
Mm, I remember. I went to one of the gigs.
Yes. I won't name it, but he read a book in between songs. Do you remember that? You just start reading, and you're like, come on, mate. People
did
he
do that at the gig I went to?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I remember him telling a story about his daughter, and then it was like the same story every night, but it seemed like it wasn't. It seemed like it was off the cuff.
Well, that's what everyone does.
Yeah, as well. That's what everyone does. My mum said that. She saw Paul McCartney, and she was a bit disappointed when she saw him next time. Like, he's done this story. I thought this was...
It'll be the same as stand-up. They'll do a little bit that seems improv.
Yeah.
And they'll do it the next night as well.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all fake. The world's fake, mate. It's all bullshit. Like, I'll tell you what is real, though.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what is real. This podcast.
It is real.
This podcast. I am Ben Winty. That is George Pickering. Welcome to another episode of Jimmy Jimmy.
Thanks, Connor. I needed thank that. You. I was going to keep talking.
Well, we've got a guest today.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, we've got the awesome Matt Hector.
Yeah. He's someone. The reason I discovered him was many drummers in my circle have mentioned him. I think either I've had lessons with him or just, you know, and I quite like when you have that organic, oh, you should have this person on if you can get them on. Both a treat for both of us, I'd say. I mean,
definitely
from his live work and his studio work, we could almost, it's almost like a...
He's a much more successful me.
Yeah.
Better drummer. Better looking, has his own studio, sessions in his own studio, and probably just way better at that as well.
But you know what I've just realised about you two? Name-wise, you have the same syllable name.
Yeah.
What, you realise that as well?
I realised it as you said. I will admit, I didn't realise that before until you said it, but I'm agreeing as we chat. That's fine. You can agree as you chat.
Yeah, you can agree as you chat.
Yeah. Three-letter first name.
Yeah.
Two syllable.
Oh shit! Hang on. What about how many letters is your surname?
Seven.
Is it? W-H-Y. Oh yeah, you got the N.
Yeah.
It's not YT. Yeah. Anyway,
he's one short. He's got six in his name. Anyway,
Ben Winty, Matt Hector. I nearly said your name wrong. That was weird. Anyway, I mean, let's just go into the podcast because I got distracted by syllables there.
Yeah, well, we all get distracted by syllables.
Very daily occurrence for me.
It really is. You keep texting me about it, and I keep saying, relax.
You send me a text, and
relax.
I go, that was seven syllables in that text.
And I say, stop doing this. You need to concentrate on your career. Your time is running out. Anyway, here's our chat with Mad Hector.
Okay.
There we go.
God, imagine drummers being this technical to be able to sort stuff out like this.
I know, this is it. It's the modern way now, isn't it? You've got to do everything.
I know, tell me about it. I'm kind of like, I've done a few podcasts recently. I should really get this shit sorted out because my Zoom game was pretty good during lockdown. But now it's just like, fucking Zoom again. So so I'm not, I apologise for being the kind of dunce in the room.
No, don't worry. No, it's all cool. I love the backdrop. Is this a teaching place? Or is this...
Well, this was actually, so this was, I built this in the first lockdown. So I built it initially for remote sessions, and then it's actually, it's quite a big space. You can't really see the full length of it because it goes back that way further. And it's become a production studio. So I still do sessions in here remote and otherwise, but I've been working as a producer a lot more recently as well. So recording albums and et cetera. So it's been brilliant, and it's been a labour of love, this place. But still, I mean, it's probably a few years old now. You kind of forget how many years has zipped past because of COVID. But it was built in the first lockdown, but no, thank you. Yeah, it's got a couple of drum kits in, your bit of teaching now and again as well.
No, it looks great. Do you want to start with the recording stuff, Ben, seeing as we're on this topic?
Yeah, sure. So, as you can see, I'm in my studio.
I can see some nice snare drums in the background. They're sexy.
So I was having a look. It's Jackdaw Studios, is that right?
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah. So, as a fellow drummer now, you know, producer, engineer, like, was that something you kind of always wanted to get into? Is that something you had much experience in before?
I think if you spend a lot of time in studios recording and working as a musician, and I think most people think, I wonder what I'd be like as a producer. And there's so many different elements to production, whether that's just someone that gets everybody in the room or someone that comes in much more like myself and my bass playing partner, Mark, will play and produce as well. So Mark's a bass player and a great engineer. So we'll find that quite often we'll play on the stuff that comes in and then we'll produce it as well as recording it all as well. So it's kind of... I think it's a sign of the times nowadays that you have to have multiple skills. You know, just being able to do one thing is great, and that might make you a living. And I mean, within the sphere of music more broadly, I'm talking obviously. But being able to do sessions, teach when you have to, when things are really bad, or do masterclasses, which I've done a bit of, do recording, produce people, start to write. You just have to have so many options and so many avenues open to yourself, just to give when one thing kind of slows down, the other thing picks up. So I think the studio thing kind of came from initially born from me building this place because of lockdown, to thinking, how the hell am I going to work now? Because all my tours cancelled within the space of a couple of weeks. And in fact, I started losing work before we even had it over, we had COVID over here. I had some stuff with Razorlight booked in Greece, and that was cancelled because it was hitting the continent before us. So, and when that all happened and work started drying up, and I lost, like all of us, all of my work really quickly, the studio was built just to try and make, when the musical universe was shutting down outside, I thought, I'll make my own new musical universe. And that's what this place has become now. But it's also ended up now, things have kind of slowly opening up again, although they're not back to normal yet. It's given me another income stream, whether that's the sessions I do, the albums we've recorded here, the artists we produce. So, yeah, it's been a great thing, and it was born out of necessity originally. But I think, going back to your original question, I think watching people produce, I thought, I think I've got something I can bring to the game here. And it's really rewarding as well to be more of a creative. Not just playing the drums, I'm looking a couple of steps back at what we're recording, how we're recording, at the songs, etc. And that feels really nice. I almost feel like a proper musician.
Do you do any engineering yourself, or do you leave that to Mark?
Well, Mark is annoyingly brilliant. So Mark's an incredible bass player, Mark Neary, if you guys want to check him out. But also he engineered, he worked at Jeremy Stacey's studio for a long time. He's a really incredible drummer. And then subsequently has just worked in all the massive, all the big studios. So he knows so much. I'm kind of on his coattails, just kind of watching and learning. I can run the session quite happily, but if he's in the room, I'm just gonna pin my ears back and listen. You know, it's always nice to be with someone who's really great at what they do when you're learning, because if you just shut up, watch and listen, you'll pick up so much. So I might be being hard on myself. Maybe I've got a few more chops than I'm letting on, but when I talk about me in context with Mark, I feel like I'm a newbie. But obviously, as a drummer and having my own studio, I can record drums really well. I know what I'm doing with the drum kit and the set of mics, and we've got good gear in here. We've got mainly outboards, so we've actually got real equipment rather than plugins, which isn't available to everybody, but I've invested in that front end. So obviously, as a drummer, yeah. I've got way too many drum kits. Way too many drum kits. So I'm kind of good with drums now, so I started spending on microphones. And then once you get past the microphones, you're into your preamps. And so I've endeavoured, because I'm lucky enough to be able to invest some money in here, to buy the best gear I possibly can. And I think it's starting to pay dividends now. So,
have you got any specific, like, drum miking techniques that you've picked up in your career that you're implementing now with your own sessions?
I think probably yes, in short. I've got techniques and things that I've learned and watch great engineers do, as well as what Mark do. But what I have learned is treating on each session and each song as a separate entity. So not to go in with any preconceived ideas, because, you know, we could go with the Coles as overheads, which are beautiful mics, but for a rock song, they're not necessarily going to sound right. So I think the starting point is, what does this song need from the drums? If we're talking drums, that is. How do we get the best sound, and how do we get something different? How do we not just replicate over and over again that same thing? I think what I've got maybe is an understanding of what mic configuration gives me a certain sound. So if I hear, I don't know, for instance, if we had some kind of rootsy blues thing, then I'd have a rough idea. It's probably going to be a few mics as I can get away with. The less, the better, so it's more organic sounding. Then if we go to a heavily produced pop song, then we're, you know, potentially talking, we mic up everything as well as my seat, you know. So you've got a rough guide, but no preconceived ideas, I think, is a really good starting point, because otherwise I think people can get stuck in this situation of, that's how I mic drums up, that's how I record drums. No, that's just the way I do it. And I've been in some studios like that where they've gone straight to the thing they always do. That's always worked for them, which is understandable, but I want us to find something different. I don't want it just to be like the last one. It's like, what can we do to make this special? And I think that's probably a good approach with everything, really.
How do you convey that to your clients? And in terms of, does that lead to like extended periods of setting up and experimentation? Because obviously, you know, a lot of clients have eyes on budget.
Sure.
So do you struggle at all to convey that across to people, or are they kind of going, what are you doing, or why are we taking so long doing this? Because I think people underestimate just how long it takes to get drums recording ready. Do you have any issues with that sort of thing, or is everyone pretty cool with it?
No, we're pretty cool. I mean, I think if you're working with people who are energised, as in, I'm kind of like, I've got way too much energy, and so is Mark as well, so... It's very apparent to people that come and work with us. It's like, well, they're getting 150% straight away. So if they've, so we essentially say, well, this is what we think. This is our idea. We'll try it. If you don't like it, then we'll start again and we'll try something different. And that's not just miking techniques. I mean, we're talking the drums, what we're playing, everything. Everything's open to discussion, because there's only one thing important. That's the song and the client and us doing the best for them. So, so far, we've not really had any problems. People have kind of trusted us, and it's worked out well. So, and if it's not worked, we change it. So, yeah, no, it's been pretty fine, really. And I'm not really much of a clock watcher, really. It's not like we must stop working at 8 o'clock or six or whatever. It's like, well, we want to do a really good job on this song, so we're going to keep going until it's right. And that can include the sound as well. But you are right, micing up drums. Especially in this studio, which we record in the round, so there's no isolation, we're all in the room together, which I really, really like. But that does mean the initial drum sound takes a little bit longer because we're recording, listening, rather than being in a separate control room.
Yeah, I was going to ask how that worked in terms of we have separation here. So I just wondered, yeah, what your process was for tracking drums in the, essentially the same as the control room and how you navigated that.
Well, I mean, initially, we know the space really well now. So we know where the issues might lie sonically. I've done enough sessions in this room with a plethora of different drum kits to know which ones suit which sound. So probably like you guys, you know, you, if someone says, I don't know, can we go for a Levon Helm sound or can we go for a Dave Grohl sound, you know essentially what drums straight away that makes you think, okay, WFL or a TAM or something. You think of a sound straight away. So that side of the process is quite quick. And also because we've worked in here a lot, we know what mics sound good pretty straight away. So generally what we're testing for is just making sure our levels are right, making sure that the tone we're expecting to hear is coming out. It does mean I'll play, we'll listen, we'll play, I'll listen. But that the negative side of that, which takes a little bit longer, I think is mitigated when we're then sitting in the room together. There's not a barrier. You know, we can communicate really quickly. It's instantaneous. We can listen back, we can play, and it's so quick, it feels like it's a really fast creative process and reflective as well. We can sit and play in the same room together, obviously not necessarily with the amps in here, etc. We've got an isolation room for the amps. But that process I really like. There's a little vibe in here. You come in and you sit down and we feel like we're in this together. We don't feel like the drums are in a booth by themselves. I'm not putting that down, but from my experience, I really like that in the round. There's a producer called Ethan Johns, who's an incredible producer, who records in the round as well. I mean, he's got a bigger space than this, but still, it's a really nice way of recording. And once, if you can get over the technical aspects and learning how to get past those things quickly, it's a really nice way to work. We always feel like we're in it together. You can feel the excitement in the room and something's right. You can see when it's wrong as well. It's very quick and instant when you're in the process of being creative, which I really like.
Do you have many other drummers come in and record with you guys?
We've had a few, and that's great. It's really nice. It's really nice to see how they feel, how they record. It's always great to watch anybody else play with a different approach, you know, not just in here, everywhere, you know. And it's been really cool, and because obviously I know I can understand what that drummer sitting in that seat needs in this space, and that's a really useful thing as well. From one drummer to another drummer, it's like I know what it's like to sit there and what it sounds like and what I need to play well. So usually by the time they sit there, I've already got a lot of that stuff dialed in. So I'll be running Pro Tools and Mark will be doing the mic and stuff. So we'll have it dialed in pretty quickly. So, but it's been fun. It's been nice to watch people in here and. Because that wall's really nice to play in front of as well, the wood blocks. Good for photo ops.
What is that wall made of?
Well, so it's basically, they were massive, great long lengths of 7x3, which is like essentially ceiling joists, massive. Right. And I kind of wanted something that looked nice and also diffused the sound. I mean, it's quite a... It's not... You can obviously get diffusers that will hit a certain frequency. This is much more of just a dialing down of the whole room. And you can probably see, if I just turn this around, you can see it. So it's all around this wall here and stuff. So, and it smells nice, which is good for a studio.
It's always a perk.
Yeah, it is, yeah. So you come in here and it feels like, it just smells like a pine forest, which is really nice.
Yeah, And
it's definitely subdued any nasty overtones as well, which was the main reason, really. Because before there was just a plastered wall back there with some diffusion. But that now, the kit back there sounds really warm and fat and round sounding. There's no nastiness. I just did a session, actually, last week, and the guy rang me today and we were chatting about it, and he said that the drums sound so beautiful, beautifully warm and round and fat. Every mic sounded rich. So I'm happy with that. We use Neve preamps, so that's kind of, it's that Neve sound in this space works really well, I think.
Go on, Ben. Anything else you want to ask? I'm eager to ask about live work.
I'm the studio guy. George is the live guy.
That's cool. Wow, pincer movement.
Yeah.
This is the only downside of doing this podcast as a duo. It's sort of like, is he going to ask something or should I go? You know, it's like just talking over each other a lot.
It's like a little marriage. It's really good so far. You're kind of beautifully, beautifully dovetailed.
We're learning over the years. Yeah, like a little eyebrow, a little.
Shut up.
Do you have drummers? I guess like it's primarily your setup. For yourself to be the drummer on the recordings, are you? Is that the main goal of the studio?
Yeah. I mean, because this is it's an idiosyncratic studio and the space and the way it's run and how we get our sound. So it's not somewhere you'd do a dry hire. You know, you wouldn't just hire this and have an engineer to show the band's engineer how it works. It's a production studio, and the production studio is me and Mark. So generally, people that come here, they want to work with us. That doesn't mean we necessarily have to play, but quite often we do, because in this space you've got an incredible bass player, the drummer's okay, you've got really good gear, and then we then produce as well. So you get, it's quite an all-encompassing package here. Apart from, we do pretty much everything apart from the mastering. So most people utilise us as a rhythm section, but who knows, that's not necessarily the way it's going to stay. As we produce more and more work, I think that will change, and it'll be more about our sonic kind of ideas and creative ideas, less about just our playing.
Do people ever come in? I mean, we'll get onto live stuff, but you know, say for example, who are big Iggy Pop fans or something, and they go, "I want you to do what you do with Iggy Pop on my records." Is it ever that sort of vibe?
Or? Yeah, of course. I mean, so because I was with Iggy for 5 or 6 years. A lot of people will think of me in that light. Mm. Despite the fact, randomly, I'm not really that kind of drummer.
No.
So, you know, the place I came from was not heavy or punky or, you know, so whereas, because I've been identified with such a big act like Iggy, people just assume that's what I do. So I have been asked for that quite a few times, and that's completely cool. You know, whatever I can do to, of course, that's not going to ever be a problem, but working with someone like Iggy attracts attention where people want a bit of that, you know, and that's not necessarily just people saying, can you play like that? It can be them trying to connect with you, almost like a backdoor to Iggy, you know, and it can be, and they're usually quite transparent people that want to ingratiate themselves, and because they think that you've got a direct phone line to him, which I understand that kind of hustle. It's a bit disappointing when it happens, and it's a bit of a shame. But I also, it's hard to be really hard on those people because they're just trying to make a living in music and they're trying to further their careers. I completely get that. But I've had it enough now. It's like, this dude doesn't want to record here. He wants to come down and say hello and check out the studio and then play me his demo or play me a song, hoping that I'll play it to get it to Iggy somehow. That happens. That's happened quite a lot. But like I say, I've told a few people, you know how bad this looks. You know what you're doing is really shitty.
And,
yes, I've had at least one conversation like that where I just felt like, look, I'm going to tell you the truth here about how you're coming across.
Yeah.
And you took it pretty well. But, so that's an interesting part of being involved with someone who has a big presence.
I can't imagine. Yeah, that's shitty that someone would do that. I can't imagine doing that.
Like, well, people always speak to you, George, to try and get to me. That's what
I'm saying. Mate, I'm going to speak to him to get to you now.
That's right. Come on. My only interpretation of that ever happening, I used to work at Brighton Football Grounds, the training club, and people used to get jobs there just so they could hang out with the Brighton players. But I was so clueless on football that I just sort of...
It didn't bother you.
That's why they didn't mind me working there. They were like, he doesn't even know who the players are. It's all good. I mean, if we could chat about Iggy Pop for a little bit. I actually saw you play with him at Isle of Wight Festival.
Oh, wow.
In 2016.
Yeah.
And I remember you were on at about 7. And then I remember the Undertones? No. Who did the song Ever Fallen in Love? I can't remember. Buzzcocks. The Buzzcocks were on at 7:20. I was like, oh, I want to see both. So I saw, I think, first 10 minutes of Iggy and you, and then I ran to the other place. And thankfully, you played my two favourite Iggy songs.
Yeah.
I kind of wanted to ask about sound, because obviously, you know, The main question was, how close are you trying to sound, make it sound like the Stooges, or is it not like that, if that makes sense? Are you trying to sound like those 70s records when you were playing with him, or
yes,
is it a bit more modern?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Within reason.
Yeah.
I mean, so when we started that gig, our feeling was that previous bands hadn't really really paid homage to the stuff that Iggy had done and the Stooges, you know. Mm. That was groundbreaking and very important to a lot of people. The sounds they got, the way they played it. And I think some of the bands after the later part felt like it was about them, you know. Now, when you play with Iggy playing Stooges songs, it's not about me. It's about him, and it's about the music that's come from. So we wanted to serve those songs and deliver those songs as best we could in a truthful way, but pay homage to where they came from. So a lot of the drum choices were down to, well, what does Lust for Life sound like? How was that recorded? What were the drums they used? You know, and then how do I use, if I use that as a zero, how do I use that sound and make it work across the whole genre of stuff that he's done? Because we ended up doing some of the post-pop depression stuff, which was Matt Helders.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you'd go from like this massive open drum sound to quite dead and close. So you have to kind of work out on a live set what kit will serve all those songs the best. But we definitely spent time listening to the originals and working out why is Lust for Life so good? Why is that groove so brilliant, you know?
Yeah.
And the beauty of this is it's not like we wanted a tribute act. We were playing the songs and we wanted people to experience them and try and find them, some of the magic that was involved in the originals. So, I mean, I remember when the MD, Kevin Armstrong, who's a really good friend of mine, he's like my older brother almost, we recorded me playing Lust for Life and then looked at the intro. We put both of them in Pro Tools and looked to try and work out and listen what was the magic that was going on with the original that I didn't have at the time. I mean, Kevin's an incredible musician. I mean, he roasts me all the time. Yeah, literally, he'll say nothing other than to tell me that something's bad, and then maybe once every in a blue moon, I might get a compliment, which is like the sun is shining. Ah, when he gives you a compliment, but we looked at how he was playing that groove to try and capture some of that energy, because when it starts, that's one of a pretty iconic drum intro.
Yeah.
So, it is. And he would. What was it now? It's a few years since we had that initial conversation. But from memory, he was lazy on the hi-hat but driving the snare drum quite hard in terms of placement.
Right.
So, and it gave it a certain swing and the way you played the bass drum. So we literally went into that depth, especially for that tune for drums. So that married with the my favourite kit with Iggy was the silver chrome kit with a 26-inch kick, massive. And that had that thing, that kind of big open sound. You sit behind it and you want to play Lust for Life. It's just like it's kind of humming. You just look at it and it's going, waiting for you to play it. It was really exciting. Going back to in answer, we did. We paid homage to those tunes and they deserved them. You know, Iggy's a treasure now. You know, he's an icon. So we're going to serve the songs best. We did serve the songs the best possible way we could, and part of that was Sonics.
I mean, that groove doesn't change throughout the song. It's that's amazing. It must have been nice, I guess, to delve that deep into a groove and really go, right, we're doing this.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a good template for anything, really. You know, when I'm still trying to get better at grooving. You know, that's never going to change. But the increments you're talking about to make something swing and it not, you know, 10 milliseconds here or there, 5 milliseconds here or there, you know, can make something work or not. So it's understanding that if you're just picking up drumsticks and you're going to be a professional and you want to get really, really great at it, at some point you're going to be looking at those increments of it being, because you've got that steep learning curve, then it's going to do that. And then every little battle, every little improvement's hard won, and literally you get to a point where every little improvement is 15 milliseconds, 10 milliseconds, 5 milliseconds to get to consistency and get to groove and swing, and that's that's the level of detail we're talking about to make something really great.
How obvious was it, the difference between you first playing it for the MD and then the eventual? Could you go, wow, this is different? Or
I'd guess it was probably stark. I might be being hard on myself. I think it was, you know, it was the things that you can't go, okay, that's wrong. You're playing that. It wasn't that. It was, okay, that's not quite right. Or he's playing it with more intent. You know, it's those things. It's like you can hear he means it. And that's a hard thing to teach. You know, I've worked with musicians. I worked with a piano player recently who was an orchestrator. And when he plays, everything he plays, he means it. Even when he looks like he's relaxed, his hands and the noise that are coming out, it's all got purpose and meaning and a reason to be there. So that's probably the things we were talking about more than, well, that you're missing a snare drum beat there. All the bits are in the right place. It was just understanding how to put them in the right place, how to play them with the right way. You know, the difference between playing a ballad and a funk song, you know, there's a feeling about how you approach it that changes how it sounds. So it's probably those things we were talking about more than the actual just the mechanics of it. I mean, I'd experiment with it. We used to do a song called Down on the Street, which is a great riff with a really great drum pattern, but it's kind of dumb. And I think Iggy described Scott, the drummer, as like a boxer when he played this song. So I literally would hold the drumstick like a hammer to make myself less dexterous on the hi-hat. And just that simple physical thing made it feel more just punchy and aggressive and less like, oh, my rella's perfect. You know, it's none of that. It was like, literally. It gave it a sound and an energy, which if you get too caught up in perfect technique, you might miss those kind of things. So, guys, I need to piss really quickly. When you get old, it's just like, I've been to the gym and I drank too much water. I'd be too sick, sorry. You can leave this in if you want.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for that, old man needs a piss break. That was a lot. I think the only thing I'd like to add to that, what you're saying about the playing dumb thing, I'm just keen always to try and find how it can sound like I'm not thinking about that I'm playing. I'm not thinking about technique. I'm not thinking about the drum. I'm thinking about the music and how I'm engaged with it and how I feel or how we all feel. So it stops being a technical exercise and it becomes something that other people are going to feel. If it sounds like a drum chop or a drum exercise or, I know, a band practicing and rehearsing something complicated, that's never going to touch anybody. It's not going to touch me. So I'm looking for what is the thing that gets me excited and emotionally engaged while I'm playing it as well. Is this moving me? Because if it moves me, it moves somebody else. If I'm just there thinking, God, yeah, that feel was so tight, my technique was bang on, it's just like that. It's just like, whoa, alarm bells.
Yeah.
Whereas, oh, that was exciting. That felt sad. That felt happy. That felt engaged. That's way, way more important for music, for me anyway.
Is that the mindset, I've got to ask, going into Lust for Life, to be specific on that song? When you're about to start that live, is that what you're thinking? Are you thinking, let's just go for it?
Fuck yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I think obviously for the first few gigs you still got to have enough focus to do the job. It's not like a band and where you just go, I'm going to create now because you're working for an artist. So it needs to be, you still need to deliver, but he particularly Iggy, he's really visceral. He's emotionally powerful and engaging on stage. So I'm trying to be in that headspace while still being professional and delivering what he needs. But I mean, the first time we played it, it was a festival called Down the Rabbit Hole in Denmark, or I think it was, a huge audience, and I just started that and the whole crowd went crazy and it almost knocked my concentration because it's fucking brilliant. It's just like the best thing in the world, and you know, for those however many bars it was, 4 or 8 or whatever it was, you know, it's because they know what it is, but it's just me playing, and as a drummer, you know, that was a real gift. Those few moments of, they know, everyone knows what this is, and they're going potty, and it's just me sitting there thrashing away. You know, if you don't give into that excitement while keeping it under wraps a little bit, what's the point? It's gonna work an office. Yeah. Enjoy it, love
it. It's interesting talking about the excitement element, because I can, you know, get carried away on a gig and stand up or something, you know. And I remember talking to my drum teacher about this, Pat Garvey, and he was he's saying it's that thing of you have to almost make it the same on bar one of the first song at the end of the set, you know, and it's like it can lead to, you know, oh, this is brilliant. And especially if the crowd is enjoying it, you can sort of, and you listen back and we're like, oh my God, was that what I was playing? Yeah. But I guess if the passion's there. But I can imagine, because Lust for Life, just to go back to that, that's almost, I mean, that drum intro, I mean, is almost, it's a hook in itself.
Yeah,
so
it is.
I can imagine, well, I can't imagine, but yeah, playing that live.
Hunt says, he's an incredible drummer. There's just a joy in it. There's a joy in the way that sounds, you know, it's great fun to play.
One last question on that. Are you thinking, I'm guessing not, but I don't want to answer for you.
No,
are
that's
you
cool.
Thinking at all of, okay, I remember the MD saying, lazy on the hi-hat, you know, fast on, or at that point, are you just like, let's just go for it?
I'm trying. I'd always try not to think about anything like that once you're on stage.
Yeah.
The time for those thoughts are either you solo practice when you're by yourself or when you're routining it, when you're rehearsing it. As soon as you're on that stage, your brain needs to be in a different place rather than technique. Well, especially on that gig, you know, it's not. You just need to disengage that part of your brain if you can. There's certain elements, parts of the set where I'd concentrate more because I know, okay, if I'm not completely switched on here, something might go awry, it might be a bit loose. But yeah, it was an interesting gig. One thing that was interesting was his energy is off the scale. You know. He's got more energy than I had when I was 20. And what I learned to my cost after the first couple of gigs is he would be straight out of the gates like that. Before we go on stage, he'd be bouncing off the side of the tent. You know, it was insane. And I got caught up in that a little bit. And I think we always, with Lust for Life and The Passenger would be the first two of the first three songs, they'd be quick out the gate. And you could easily exhaust yourself in the first three songs going crazy because he's doing that. So I had to learn how to kind of go crazy but still hold back a little bit because there's like another hour 15 left yet. And literally I'll be halfway through, yeah. Like, I'm exhausted, you know. So you have to, I had to learn how to give that energy off, but just have a little bit back ready for to survive the rest of the gig. Because he'd be on the bass drum, he'd be rattling the front of the bass drum, screaming at me, you know, come on, motherfuckers, you know, he wants everything faster, louder, and you have to just listen to that, but equally, we know where it's supposed to be and where we hold it up. Because if we did everything, I mean, and half of what he's saying is for show to a certain degree, you know, that's his energy. But if we all did that, it would be like 50 BPM faster before you know it. So it was an interesting dichotomy, the way those two things, the energy and the abandon with the just holding on to a bit of focus and energy. It was a good challenge.
Yeah, I guess that's a tricky balance to find. You don't want to all strip off nude and then run around the stage. Like
no that. One would want that. That would be horrific and probably illegal as well. But yeah. Ben, what country are you in? Do you do that? Is that what Pat taught you?
Yeah, that's the lessons of Pat. Yeah. He teaches you how to get nude and run around the stage.
If
it's out, just do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's definitely going to have an impact, isn't it? It's going to...
Yeah, it's certainly memorable. Ben, did you want to ask something about groove?
Yeah, I see your groove coming a lot up next to your name. And a lot of stuff we see online, on Instagram, people's videos, is so technique, speed, those sorts of things. Do you think that the art of groove is being lost a bit with the younger generation? Is that something that is quite core to your teaching?
I think it's any good drummer is going to be core to their teaching. Or any good teacher, aside from the technique we have to learn to give us faculty to play, anyone that I respect values the groove. I mean, whether that's... And when I say, you know, groove can... You can have groove in metal, you can have groove in jazz, you can have grooves in... It's a different... They're different kinds of grooves, but there's a pocket there with all of them. So I think groove is probably a byword for setting up a pocket and a feel that suits the song. And sometimes that, you know, tempo can move. There's nothing wrong with that in the right circumstance. But I think, to your question, I don't know. I see a lot of the kind of guys around at the moment that I respect, you know, Alex Torvinson, Freddie Sheed, you know, these guys are big groovers, you know, and, you know, immaculate players for that kind of thing. So Matt Ingram's another great player, studio owner, a friend of mine as well, who plays awesome. And none of them are in super chopsy at all. I think they've probably got it if they want it, but they just play immaculate groove and it feels nice and the sound's good. So if they're indicative of, because they're a little bit younger than me, if they're indicative of what's below them as well, I think we're fine. I hear a lot of conversation. I mean, Ash Jones, you know, massive name. And that is completely his vibe. He has his sound and plays in his way, but it's all centred around a groove, about groove and song playing. So I don't feel like it's in an unhealthy place. I try not to watch. I don't really watch drummers on YouTube and doing stuff in their bedroom or in their studio by themselves. As incredible as it is, I listen to music more. So, I'm not AC anymore, but I was there. It was a few years since I've been, but the young guys, they were all plugged into that vibe as well. Some of them had some ridiculous chops as well, and I'm definitely not down on that. That's not my thing, but they could also lay it down and play it consistently when they had to as well. So it feels pretty healthy at the moment. I don't think the music business per se is particularly healthy, but I think the musicians, they're doing all right. Drummers are okay. We're good guys. We'll be all right.
If you think someone's lacking a bit in the groove sense of their playing, maybe a slightly less experienced drummer or someone a bit younger, or how do you teach that? Can you teach it? Is it something that just comes over time? How do you explain it to people, what it even is?
Well, I mean, there are fundamentals, obviously timekeeping, consistency and internal sound levels. There are three fundamental things that if you can work on, they're going to improve. You know, obviously, I spend a huge amount of time when I do practice doing disappearing click. I'll do that for hours. So, and I think that greatly, that's always helped me. That's been a really useful tool. The consistency thing, you know, again, these things I'm working on myself all the time. You can understand that by watching, recording yourself, listening back. I look at myself in Pro Tools a lot, so I can see where things are moving, because you can't often notice them yourself when you're playing. And then finally, the sound level thing. That's harder because it feels counterintuitive when people are bashing away, having a really great time. That it's like you understand how loud those cymbals are that you're smashing the living shit out of, and that sound is obliterating every other part of the groove, and all it sounds like is a trashy loud hi-hat with this quiet bass drum and snare drum underneath it. So it could be perfectly in time, but that's not grooving. So understanding when to manipulate your internal volumes, your kick and your snare and your hat, depending on the style. And that's another thing, stylistic awareness as well comes into groove. Understanding whether you're playing AC/DC and you're thwacking the shit out of that snare and bass drum, or if you're playing something jazzy and it's all been driven by the ride cymbal. Understanding those fundamentals in music, I think you can learn. I think what's tougher to learn or to change is where you naturally feel something. I think that's a thing that's harder to teach. You can practice the other stuff, but I don't think... And you can become super, super aware of where you put things, but then getting yourself to play things in a different place to where you would normally is, I found tough. I tend to sit... I'm not behind, I'm not in front. I can get pushy when I get excited, which is most of the time, to be fair. So that's hard. I'm never going to be a behind-the-beat player. Maybe that's defeatist. Maybe I will, but that's probably the hardest thing for me to change and for somebody else to change. The other stuff you can practice, I think. And maybe you can practice... When I find pushy drummers, I try and tell them to imagine that they're playing slower. Try and imagine you're playing with a bass player that's really pushy, how you're trying to hold them back. So try and think of conceptual ways to get them to change. But when... you stop thinking, you just play. I think that's harder to teach, is how you naturally play when you don't think. That's good.
Yeah,
thank you. That was a good response. I'll stroke my beard. We all got beards. We are three sexy dudes. Yeah.
You mentioned disappearing click. Is that something you regularly into your practice routine, and just run by for people what for you that is?
Okay, so I'll play, I don't know, depends how much time I've got, obviously, but I'll play three or four different kind of feels. Actually, you know, I do use it a lot. If I've got a new gig, I might play through some of the more complicated grooves that I'm going to play live with that click, feeling everything and grooving, and just so I understand how I'm not really concentrating what's happening to my time when I'm playing that song. But if I wasn't practicing it specifically, I'd just look for three or four different patterns, whether that's a quarter note thing on the hat, a shuffle, a 16th hand single Beccaro kind of groove, something more double timey, just variations in grooves, and then I'll sit for 25, 30 minutes on each groove and try and just sit there for 30 minutes on that groove and not change.
Wow.
It's hard. It's in quite an intense focus, but if you can do it even for 20 minutes or 30 minutes and be disciplined enough not to play a feel, not to move from that, your awareness becomes really highly tuned. You know you've moved before you get to the click. You know that snare drum was there. You can find yourself, oh no, and you pull it back and you hit the click again. You can hear yourself moving, and that awareness, you know, that's really valuable. I think particularly with time, that's really important. I remember I watched the Benny Greb thing when he was talking about timekeeping, and how that anyone can get better at it. But it's like being on a tightrope, I think. I don't know if you guys have seen this thing, but he said, when you're learning tightrope to start off with, you'll stand on the line and you'll be like, you're wobbling this way, then you're wobbling that way, and it's like you're kind of swinging all over the place just to hold it in place. But then as you get better at it, you kind of, the movements become smaller, until eventually you look like you're still, but actually you're just making tiny micro adjustments. And I really like that as a thing with time. As you get better at good tempo, it's not that you're like a computer in the same place every time, it's just you're just catching yourself really quickly and just straightening it out before you speed up or slow down. You've caught that little twitch. And I found doing the disappearing click for that period of time on different patterns, I would hear that and see that. I'd feel myself move and wobble. So over time, you stop that happening, or the kind of recalibrations are a lot smaller. So that's why the disappearing click is what something I've used all the time. I just really like it. It's almost kind of meditative. You know, you sit there and concentrate, sit there, breathe and play. And I really like that as a thing.
I saw you have done some, like a drum sample pack.
Ah, yeah, the Toon Track stuff.
Toon Track, Superior Drummer.
Yeah.
Like, just quickly, you went in and you actually played these samples?
Every single
sample. How was that? How long did it take? What's the process?
Forever! <Yeah. laughs> No, it was really fun. So we did it at Rockfield Studios, which is just an incredible place. Lots of massive records, some of my favourite kind of, I know, Black Sabbath stuff and Queen and people like that. But literally, it was long and laborious. It was with an incredible... So the main guy was a guy called Tom Dalgetty. He was the producer, who was incredible. Did all the Royal Blood early stuff when they became successful. So it was his kind of pack, and I was the drummer that kind of worked alongside him. But literally, we would have a snare drum, for instance, and I'd sit there and I would hit it in the middle as delicately as I could for, I don't know, 10 times. And then I had to get from that to full volume and everything in between. So maybe 13 or 14 different volume levels. And that was just the centre of the drum. Then you go in an inch. I shit you not. Then you go in another inch. Then you get as close to the rim as you can. Then you do a rim shot. So every single drum was sampled at every single velocity in pretty much every single location on it, and the same with the cymbals. So bearing in mind, every time you hit a cymbal, ting, wait for it to die, ting, the bell, the edge, every part of that cymbal was hit. I mean, it's an incredible thing to do, and listening back to the sounds we recorded with some of the MIDI that I recorded to go alongside it, it's mind-boggling, really. But it took a long time. I think we did... How many kits? We must have done like 7 or 8 kits. I think 30 or 40 snare drums. It's just a huge library of sound, and in different parts, different studios as well. That was fun but long. With it also, a shout out to Joe Cox. I don't know if you guys know Joe, but he sells and restores vintage drums, but he's also an incredible drum tech as well. So he's out with Alex Torrenson, I think. His job was to tune, and my job was to sit there for hours and then hitting the bloody things. So Joe's incredible. Check out Joe Cox for some of his gear as well. Great vintage drums.
Wow. Yeah, that's a long day.
Yeah, I imagine that's what went on, but I think you just load the sample you think about, you know, we'll take samples of sessions here and just one hits, really, and then you're like, every drum, every velocity,
it's an incredible thing to do. I mean, I'm really proud of it. I think it's one of their most popular packs. It was fun. It was long, by myself in a room hitting a drum for it in every possible way. So I'm glad you enjoy it. You can feel the love I gave it. I hope it's coming across.
I've just never met anyone who's actually been the drummer, you know, on one of those things. So
it's everything.
People, if you're using samples, there is a real person hitting that drum 1,000 times. Be grateful.
It's kind of crazy to think that's. But so some of my friends have sent me stuff they've done, and to think, I mean, it's just a sample, but the sounds that have been made, that was me hitting the drum, which is a really weird kind of thing to get your head around when it's in that kind of context.
Yeah, definitely. I can imagine the ones in between. Just one last thing, saying you're hitting the snare, if you hit it as quietly as you can, but imagine when you get to, if you do 13 hits, hit number 6 or 7, you're like, it was this more like a 3 or...
It was go too early, go too loud, and they're like, right, we've got 4 more levels. You're like, shit, how about... Yeah.
I'm done. Yeah, in about. Yeah, I mean, as hard as I can. Yeah, I need bigger sticks. No, but it was it was literally like that. I mean, but after the first day, I'd kind of understood. But you definitely get physical. You start looking at your hand, trying to get the height, because they need to be consistent. So otherwise, you do it again. It's like, oh no, you were going. You were starting to get a bit louder in that little articulation. Can you change that? But the rim shots as well. Everything trying to be quiet. It was actually really. Good learning thing, the learning experience from that regard. But God, mind melting.
Well, right. Shall we go to the last question, Ben?
Yes. Matt, who is your favourite delivery company?
Wow. DPD. It's got to be there DPD. You know, I just like the kind of fact that you can see the little car and it's getting near and tell you what number it's on. You can, like, because I'm so impatient, it's unbelievable. and having that kind of deals with that part of my personality, I can see them come in. I mean, it's funny that I actually had an answer to that question, which is kind of comedic, but no, I completely get what you mean. Yeah, definitely DPD.
It's DPD is becoming the regular answer now.
Yeah.
You know, amongst all guests.
Yeah, I'd say overall the number one pick.
Mm. You got
it's the window. As Jay Sikora said, it's the window. You get the hour window.
Yeah.
You see it all happening.
You should definitely shout them up for some kind of endorsement stroke deal for this. Yeah, I don't know what that would involve, but hey, I'm never shy of asking for stuff like that.
That's it. We've asked this question since the beginning. I think by accident we've sort of surveyed more people on delivery companies than anyone, you know what I mean? We've really found that amongst the UK, DPD is the winner, you know?
Yeah. So, if the nation needed a true representation of drummers' favourite delivery companies, we got it covered.
But is there any better yardstick than kind of a guy waiting for a snare drum to turn up? I mean, that is, we're talking intense pressure there and expectation. So it's not like, I know, a dishwasher or a washing machine. It's like, this is exciting. It really matters.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
It's usually expensive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Fragile.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on.
No, it's my pleasure. It's lovely to chat to you both. You're a wicked team.
Great. Thank you so much.
Where can people find you and what's coming up next for the rest of your year?
I'm waiting on something that I'm not allowed to talk about, which sounds really shitty and corny. But that should be happening in the next couple of weeks. Some are very cool. And apart from that, it's all studio sessions at the moment. So touring things kind of hit and miss. I had some stuff in the diary that's cancelled because of touring problems. This is a bit of indicative of the situation, but anyway, loads of studio stuff, so I'm really happy with that, and maybe something else cool soon. All right, guys, lovely chat. Bye.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Cheers, mate.
See you later, mate. Bye.
There we go. I'm leaving that in.
Yeah.
You know, you say there we go 50 times. You got to do it a bit different.
It wasn't even that. It's the fact that we do the intro and then immediately after do the outro. And it's as if, you know, there wasn't an hour separation. No. That was a great chat, though.
Yeah, I really enjoyed good. That. Yeah,
that was really good.
I feel like we really picked his brain.
Yeah. But you know? Also, he was one of those, to be specific and blunt about it, he was one of those guests who was brilliant because he could really answer a question, you know? The stuff about Lust for Life, that was amazing. I wanted to talk about Iggy Pop and almost specifically that song. So when he brought it up and talking about the absolute microseconds of displacement, but changing, you know, the groove. I thought that was fascinating. I think it is, and I'd said it to him, and it's an interesting topic of, as you, I don't know, progress as a drummer or in any creative space or anything really, the improvements, they seem smaller, but they're as significant as the improvements that seem bigger. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know what you're saying, yeah.
He said it better than me.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Way better.
Definitely. Yeah, thanks to Matt for coming on. We both had Spag Bowl last night. Let's talk about that.
Oh, we're doing the Spag Bowl. Okay. I thought you weren't going to do it. No. What do you want to ask about my Spag Bowl?
No, nothing really.
Why bring it up?
First saw each other today. And it's weird again because we're both in my studio, but you're in the office. I'm in here. Logistics of a travelling vagrant like yourself.
Mm.
But we found out, yeah, Wednesday night was Spag Bowl night for us both. You had a good one. I had a good one.
I had a great one. Do you know what I did as well? I bought Parmesan and cut off the Parmesan rind and put that in the bolognese. You ever done that?
No.
No, God, no.
block of cheap cheddar. Let's go.
No. But like, this isn't grated over it. This is...
I'm lucky if there's a vegetable in mine, mate.
Well, this is it, yeah. I had carrots in mine. But it's cooked for so long that they're not really there anymore, you know?
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, reduce that for hours. Do you know what I enjoy? I'll end with this. If you're still listening and you wanted the Matt Hector interview is done now. This is now just us talking about Spag Bowl. I enjoy being in the kitchen, washing up, cleaning about, but you've got a sauce on the go or a meal, and you just have to stir it every now and then, every 5 minutes. Oh, make sure it's not stuck to the bottom, and it just keeps reducing. And then, you know, because every Spag Bowl starts the same. You look at it and you've got some mince and some veg and tinned tomatoes. I make it from scratch, and you go, that's never going to work. It's just wet. It's just like red water and mince.
Yeah.
But then you keep that going. Oh, hello. It just melts away, and then suddenly you're like, oh, there it is.
It's like starting a mix.
Yeah.
You're like, produce is like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
And then you just keep working it, keep reducing that mix, and eventually you get an average song.
Well, there you go.
Right, I got one little gripe with life.
Okay, I thought you were going to say with Matt. I was like, fuck.
No.
Jesus.
No. I got no beef with Matt.
No.
I wonder if he had Spag Bowl last night. Forgot to ask.
We'll message him.
We'll message him and let you all know. right, so I used to be, I'm not a chef, as you know.
Yeah, I definitely know that. I once went to your flat, you had a pestle and mortar. I said, have you ever used that? You went, no.
No, of course not. No. I also had a selection of ladles and things on a rack that never used, just for show. Anyway, that's another. The ones I use are in the drawer. So I used to just be a jar guy.
Yeah.
I hold my hands up. I was a jar guy. Why
He's
not? Someone's made it for me, right?
Yeah.
Just put the jar in. All good, yeah? But since the last couple of years, I have been making my
sauce frozen.
From scratch.
hang on, what? I missed all of that.
Yeah, you froze. Right,
no, you froze. You stopped on I'm a jar guy.
We're getting the internet stable. Internet is unstable. Right, quickly, yeah. I'm a jar guy, right? I've been a jar guy. But recently I have been making my sauce from scratch. So tin of plum tomatoes and all that stuff, right?
Good
and
man.
This is what bothered me. People go, oh, I make it from scratch. No, you don't. I just don't think you can fully make a meal. I don't think you can do it.
No,
you had a little thing of mixed spice in. Well, you didn't mix those fucking spices, did you?
Mm.
You know what I mean? You didn't make the stock.
Mm.
You're not making it from scratch.
Mm.
You didn't puree the tomatoes yourself to add tomato puree.
Mm.
You didn't make the cheese yourself.
No.
So cut that shit out, people, and go, oh, I'm going to make it from scratch. No, 50% of what you're putting in there, you haven't made from scratch. So you can fuck off.
I feel very attacked because I literally just said I made it from scratch and then you said people, but...
No, but I get it.
After this, I'll show you Josh Wiseman, the famous YouTube chef. I've got his book. Elfie got it for me one Christmas and it's all about that. It's saying, let's actually make things from scratch. When people are like, oh, I made a burger from scratch. It's like, well, you didn't make the bun. So he's like, make the bun. And then he's like, well, you can make your own butter. You can make your own mayo, all these different things. You know, pickle your own cucumbers or whatever. Make gherkins, you know. When does a cucumber become a gherkin? Should we end? Because otherwise...
Yeah. That's a great ending.
Right.
Go check out Matt and his stuff. Go check out the studio. Like and subscribe this podcast. Spread the word.
We did. I mentioned it on one of the recent episodes. I said, please go and like and subscribe. And we went up. We went up by one on the morning an episode came out. So,
well, just another 300 more of these, and we'll have some reputation. Thank you very much for listening. Yeah. That's been George Pickering. I've been Ben Minty. Get in touch. Email, Instagram. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Drum and Drummer. You can find us on Instagram at Drum and Drummer Podcast. And you can send us an email to drumanddrummerpod@gmail.com. Remember, just pick up the sticks and twat it.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.